This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Genesis Juice, producing organic fruit and vegetable juices preserved in glass, including ginger lemonade, apple ginger, herbal fruit tonics, and more. Information where to buy at genesisjuicecorp.com.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Amin Shafi report.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo Dillon-Dados-Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Diller, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, President Bush blocks the release of a report linking global warming and hurricanes.
Three Oregon lawmakers face questions about an industry-funded luxury trip they didn't report as an expense.
A public relations company that paid Iraqi newspapers to print encouraging news about the war is awarded another multi-million-dollar contract with U.S. forces.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,708 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 48,317 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. The website InformationClearinghouse.info reports the true civilian casualty rate may be as high as a quarter million dead.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, September 27th, 2006. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afif Ahmed Shafi. Officials have decided to remove the Chiloquin Dam, which blocks the passage of endangered Lost River and short-nosed suckers to spawning areas up the Sprague River. The Modoc Point Irrigation District voted to remove the structure last week and met on Monday to ratify the vote. Removing the dam was identified as a key project for helping endangered suckers after the Endangered Species Act forced irrigation water to be shut off to most of the 1,000 farms on the Klamath Reclamation Project during a 2001 drought. The move was intended to maintain water levels in Upper Klamath Lake, the project's main reservoir, and the primary habitat of the suckers. The U.S. Department of the Interior will pay for a removal of the 92-year-old dam. The agency will also pay to install a new pumping station and will give the district $2.4 million to create a fund to pay for operation and maintenance of the pump station. The Klamath tribes once depended on the fish as a primary source of food, and each spring they hold a ceremony to assure its continued well-being. Modoc Point Irrigation District officials will meet with the Bureau of Indian Affairs on October 2nd to formally sign a document authorizing the dam's removal.
Diamond Lake will reopen to boaters on Sunday after the removal of millions of dead fish in a restoration project that has left the popular lake temporarily barren. A California company has swept the lake's surface and shoreline of roughly 25 tons of fish carcasses, resulting from an application of a fish-killing chemical called rotenone 2 weeks ago. The scooped-up fish, which took over the trout-habitated lake, now are being used as compost on a Douglas County farm. Tests indicate that the rotenone application killed every single fish. Estimates indicate about half of the 90 million killed fish sank to the bottom, while the others floated to the surface. The dead fish on the shoreline were removed primarily near the Diamond Lake Resort and campgrounds around the Umpqua National Forest Lake. The rotenone, applied in low concentrations not toxic to birds, animals, or humans, is expected to have completely degraded by mid-October. Next spring, the lake will be restocked with 75,000 adult trout and 75,000 fingerlings.
Governor Ted Kulongoski has announced a 30-day public review and comment period on his draft Oregon Coast Coho Conservation Plan to begin October 3rd. Two town hall meetings in Tillamook and Florence will introduce the Coast Coho Conservation Plan and provide an opportunity for public input. A key component of the plan includes the New Private Lands Initiative, a volunteer habitat restoration program on private lands. The Coast Coho Conservation Plan seeks the successful rebuilding of coastal coho populations that began with the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds in 1997, ensuring sustainability of the population as required by the Native Fish Conservation Policy and adopted by the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission in 2002.
J. Nicholas of Corvallis has been inducted into the Pacific Northwest Salmon Center's Wild Salmon Hall of Fame as the top conservationist for 2006. The announcement of the selection was made Saturday during the fourth annual banquet for the center in Bremerton, Washington. Nicholas is a biologist with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's South Willamette Watershed District Office in Corvallis. Among the accomplices cited in the announcement, Nicholas served as one of the key writers of the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, as well as the author of a scientific monograph about Chinook salmon stocks of the Pacific Coast.
The World Affairs Council held a luncheon for Jenna Dorn, the executive director for a World Bank watchdog organization. Jubilee Oregon attended to raise the issue of debt forgiveness in the world's poorest countries. KBOO's Marlise Franklin reports.
We are here downtown at the University Club. Jenna Dorn, who is the executive director of the World Bank, has been speaking. Outside is an action by Jubilee Oregon. Could you tell us your name and what Jubilee Oregon is all about?
Sure. My name is Nancy Ewell, and Jubilee Oregon is the local volunteer group that is part of Jubilee, which is the worldwide grassroots movement that's calling for 100% unconditional cancellation of the debt of the world's poorest countries.
Can you give us some examples?
Sure. So in countries of the South, such as Lesotho, the government takes out loans from the World Bank for infrastructure projects such as the Khotsi Dam, which bring water and electricity to South Africa. It doesn't actually benefit the people of Lesotho, and yet the Lesotho government must pay back that loan instead of funding health care and education for the people of Lesotho.
Tell us what's happening in the House right now.
Currently this week we have the Haiti Resolution 888, which is calling for the immediate cancellation of the debt for Haiti. Haiti being the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, the World Bank has just agreed that it is a highly indebted poor country, but by the World Bank standards it could take 3 to 6 years for the debt to be canceled. We want it canceled now.
And your name is?
My name is Chris Lang. I've been co-chair with Nancy for the local Jubilee USA Network chapter in Oregon.
And you were in the room and you were listening with Jenna. What did she speak on along these lines?
Well, she's only been 9 months in this job, and as a political appointee, she was trying to make things sound hopeful. In fact, she quoted a Gallup survey talking about the optimism of Africans being their primary asset in these times. Of the questions, around 10 questions, four of them did ask about debt and debt cancellation. I think she didn't try to pretend to know more than she does in terms of directness of response. My question is, what kind of vision for the future of the World Bank is there in a time when many countries are very leery of borrowing any money from the World Bank?
She did talk about that also, about the impression that people have of the World Bank.
Yes, and she tried to talk in terms of being a grant-making body as well in conjunction with others, but as another questioner was saying, How's a bank supposed to be a grant-making body effectively and with enough trust by those participating?
Thank you. And one more time, a question to you. What kind of chance do we have in the House? Is this 888? How's it doing?
The House Resolution 888 for Haiti's debt cancellation is doing great. We only need 16 more signatures, but we do need them by the end of this week before the House goes on recess. So we're currently asking Representative Wu and Representative Walden to sign on to this resolution.
And where can people look this information up?
They can go to our national website, www.jubileeusa.org, or our local website, jubileeoregon.org.
Thank you very much for joining us. This is Marlise Franklin with KBOO News.
Sister Angela Hoffman, a University of Portland chemistry professor, has been granted a third patent in her 17 years of scientific research that could lead to less expensive anti-cancer drugs. Hoffman's research involves the anti-cancer drug Taxol, which fights cancerous cell growth. The drug is used to treat ovarian cancer, breast cancer, the AIDS-related cancer Kaposi's sarcoma, and other conditions. The active ingredient in Taxol is a compound found originally in the rare and rapidly vanishing yew tree native to the Pacific Northwest. Hoffman's most recent patent involves recovering taxanes from soil around yew trees and other plants that are grown to produce Taxol. Hoffman, who grew up in Lacey, Washington, is a Catholic nun of the Order of St. Benedict. She has taught chemistry at the University of Portland since 1989. She began her research 17 years ago when one of her students showed her an article about Taxol.
Cancer patients taking high doses of vitamin D experience a reduction in blood clots, according to a new research by the Oregon Health and Science University Cancer Institute. Thrombosis, or blood clots, is a serious complication in advanced cancers, and affects from 15 to 20% of all cancer patients, considered serious complications of advanced cancer, which often lead to greater rates of stroke and lung disease. In a randomized trial involving 250 patients with advanced prostate cancer in 48 clinical sites, those receiving high doses of calcitriol experienced a significant reduction in thrombosis compared with patients receiving a placebo. Calcitriol is a naturally occurring hormone and the biologically active form of vitamin D. While the clinical trial involved patients with advanced stages of prostate cancer, studies suggest that vitamin D could help reduce blood clots in a wide range of cancers.
While the November ballot in Oregon holds 10 ballot measures, one proposal gathered enough signatures but will not appear. It was aimed at increasing the number of staff in Oregon's nursing homes. It proposed a penalty for homes that failed to employ enough caregivers. But instead of producing what could have been an expensive campaign, the backers struck an agreement with the governor. During the height of this summer, Governor Kulongoski visited the Hollywood Senior Center in Portland. Standing with the initiative sponsors, he announced that instead of a ballot measure, he'd set up a task force to suggest improvements for nursing home care, which has convened three times since that announcement. The task force's recommendations aren't finished yet, but one idea that has surfaced is to increase the time an aide has to spend with each patient by about 50 minutes, from 1.6 hours a day to 2.4. Also under consideration is allocating a larger slice of the Medicaid pie to pay for the extra time and may force nursing homes to fill in a daily report outlining how many people were on duty that day. The legislature is scheduled to reconvene this January.
The new TV-fueled popularity of the Texas Hold'em version of the game poker is raising suspicions that some bars and taverns may be violating ordinances that allow friendly games for small stakes. Eugene officials say the city's 21-year-old social gaming rules don't address the poker craze and games that may or may not be legal. A new proposal would control how much players can bet and how much the house can make. In Bend and Raymond, some popular card spots have closed, at least temporarily, to avoid the risk of breaking laws. Game operators say they're willing to work with the city but object to rules that they say that could end the games. The city's proposal would eliminate all forms of house profit, including the practices of raking a portion of the pot in each hand dealt, taking a percentage each time players buy chips, and charging for participation in tournaments.
And now, time for another fine edition of KBOO's homegrown environmental series, Our Backyard, produced and hosted by our good friend, Edison Carter.
Welcome to Our Backyard, locally produced reports and commentary about issues affecting food, water, and air quality in our backyard. This edition, what do iPods, hockey sticks, car wax, canola oil, cosmetics, deodorants, shampoos, computers, home pregnancy tests, golf balls, and socks have in common? Well, that's an easy one. They're all examples of products that use something called nanotechnology. Think small, very small. Nanotechnology is the manipulation of matter at the atomic and molecular level and a fast-growing technology that's being applied across a wide array of fields. Potential applications include low-cost solar power, smart anti-cancer therapeutics that deliver drugs only to tumor cells, and storing the equivalent of the Library of Congress in a device the size of a sugar cube. Nanotechnology may well revolutionize many of the ways our society manufactures products, produces energy, and treats diseases. The National Science Foundation predicts that the global market for nanomaterial products could reach $1 trillion within a decade. Organic Consumer reports that the deliberate exploitation of the properties evident at the nanoscale is central to all these applications. These unique properties include the large surface area of various nanomaterials, which arise from their tiny particle size, absorption and radiation of highly specific wavelengths of light, their ability to penetrate cellular barriers, and their high tensile strength and durability. Carefully controlled, these properties may indeed help produce some highly beneficial products. However, these new and enhanced properties also raise the possibility of unintended and adverse consequences, both for human health and for the environment.
For example, the same binding properties that allow nanomaterials to deliver therapeutics to cancer cells might also allow the nanomaterials with these properties to deliver toxic substances to aquatic organisms. Likewise, the electrical properties that drive applications in computers may lead to oxidative damage in living tissues. Available data, while limited in scope, clearly indicate that some nanomaterials do have hazardous properties, even as ever-growing numbers of nanomaterials are already reaching the marketplace. Unfortunately, it is far from clear whether existing federal regulatory programs will provide an effective means of addressing nanomaterial risk. A congressional assessment this summer cautioned that too little money was being invested in understanding the potential health and environmental risks of manipulating matter on such a small scale. Nanotechnology presents novel health and regulatory concerns. The nanoparticles that make stronger materials are much slower to degrade and could pass more easily from organs to the bloodstream and back, creating both environmental and toxicity concerns. In point of fact, very little is known about the risks of nanotechnology. Of the over 80,000 peer-reviewed journal articles on toxicology in the last 6 years, only 0.6% even mentioned nanoparticles. And there's already insufficient funding for safety research. The U.S. government is spending over $1 billion on nanotech research and development this year alone, but only $38 million will be spent on risk-related research. That's less than 4% on safety-related concerns. In June, the Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute, a research partnership of the University of Oregon, Portland State University, Oregon State University, and the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, one of nine U.S. Department of Energy multi-program national laboratories, broke ground on the first construction phase for a new nanoscience research complex located in Eugene at the University of Oregon. When complete, sometime next year, the goal will be to develop new nanomaterials and nanomanufacturing approaches that offer a high level of performance yet pose minimal harm to human health or the environment. The idea is to produce safer nanomaterials and more efficient nanomanufacturing processes. The vision of a nanotech future is truly mind-boggling. It's possible, for example, to make superplastic ceramics that stretch like chewing gum and liquids that are magnetic. It all sounds grand, but the Joint Center for Bioethics at the University of Toronto recently published a study that assessed the current state of nanoscience and had this warning. There is a danger of derailing nanotechnology if serious study of its ethical, environmental, economic, legal, and social implications does not reach the speed of progress in the science. A showdown of the type we saw with genetically modified crops is a real possibility if these issues are not addressed early. Check out the listing of over 200 products using nanotechnology at this website, nanotechproject.org. You might be surprised just how pervasive this technology has already become. And we'll keep you updated on this story and more. And in the meantime, keep listening to KBOO News and Public Affairs and stay informed. After all, this is our backyard.
The current time is 5:18. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News, the House of Representatives has passed the Darfur Peace and Accountability Act, as states have also individually passed divestment measures from the Sudanese government. Protests rage across Indian-administered Kashmir over the impending execution of a Kashmiri man for his alleged part in the 2001 attack on India's parliament. And hear how a three-year-old in London attempted to acquire a set of brand new wheels. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
The House of Representatives easily passed legislation on the trial and treatment of detainees held at Guantanamo Bay. It'll be tougher going over in the Senate, however, where Democrats are voicing their opposition to the legislation. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
After maintaining a low profile while Republicans in the Bush administration battled over detainee legislation, Democrats are now voicing opposition. In the House, it wasn't enough. The bill passed. Democratic Representative Ellen Tauscher from California.
We need a bill that is not going to be turned over by the Supreme Court.
Tauscher and other Democrats say several aspects of this bill won't meet constitutional standards. One of those concerns deals with habeas corpus, or the ability to challenge the legality of detention. The House ruled that no amendments to alter the legislation would be allowed, but in the Senate, they are. Leaders of the Judiciary Committee, Arlen Specter, Republican from Pennsylvania, and Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, offered an amendment that would reinstate habeas corpus. But Republican Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, one of the lead architects of the bill, will oppose any such efforts.
Habeas doesn't apply to people outside the United States. Habeas has never been given to any prisoners in any other war. The Germans and the Japanese never had access to our courts in World War II to bring legal actions.
Another concern raised by some lawmakers and human rights groups is the expansion of who would be determined an enemy combatant. It would go beyond a person who simply engages in hostilities against the United States to include any person who knowingly provides support to a terrorist group. Senator Graham was quick to rebuke any claims that an American could be picked up as an enemy combatant and stripped of their right to habeas corpus. But the bill doesn't address any non-citizen legal resident of the United States.
That's one thing we didn't think about. Legal aliens are not included, and I think that would be a good thing to say. Illegal alien would have to be tried in federal court, not military commission.
This legislation allows for the indefinite detention of detainees, which is why the stripping of habeas corpus and the expansion of enemy combatants is a concern for Jennifer Daskal, the U.S. Program Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch.
You'll have a situation where the high-level detainees, the ones who are charged with the most egregious crimes, are brought before military commissions. They're confronted with the evidence against them. They're given an opportunity to respond, and there's an adjudication as to their guilt or innocence. Whereas the low-level detainees, the farmer who was picked up by a bounty hunter, will never have a chance to be confronted with the evidence against them and to contest their innocence before any independent court ever.
Another constitutional concern of the pending legislation is brought up by ranking member from the Armed Services Committee, Carl Levin.
The bill authorizes the use of evidence that is seized inside the United States without a search warrant. This provision is not limited to evidence seized from enemy combatants. It does not even preclude the seizure of evidence without a warrant from U.S. citizens. And as a result, this provision appears to authorize the use of evidence that is obtained without a warrant in violation of the United States Constitution.
Attempts to alter the provisions critics call unconstitutional will be determined by the full Senate. Observers are confident their efforts will fail. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The recent firestorm over former President Bill Clinton's culpability for the September 11th terrorist attacks, started by the recent airing of ABC's The Path to 9/11, has brought back a debate on whether Clinton or Bush is more to blame for the attacks. But according to a recent Gallup panel survey, the American public puts the primary blame on Bush rather than Clinton for the fact that bin Laden has not been captured. 53% of Americans say Bush is more to blame, compared with 36% blaming Clinton. Republicans and Democrats are largely divided into opposing camps on the question of who is more to blame for bin Laden's ability to evade capture. 71% of Republicans say Clinton is more to blame, while 83% of Democrats hold Bush more responsible.
The Bush administration has blocked the release of a report that suggests global warming is contributing to the frequency and strength of hurricanes, the journal Nature reported yesterday. The possibility that warming conditions may cause storms to become stronger has generated debate among climate and weather experts, particularly in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. In the new case, Nature said weather experts at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, part of the Commerce Department, in February set up a 7-member panel to prepare a consensus report on the views of agency scientists about global warming and hurricanes. In May, when the report was expected to be released, panel chair Ants Lietma received an email from a Commerce Department official saying that the report was too technical and would not be released. Just 2 weeks ago, researchers said most of the increase in ocean temperatures that feed hurricane intensity are the result of human-induced global warming. A study one researcher said closes the loop between climate change and powerful storms like Katrina.
The United States House of Representatives late on Monday gave final passage to the Darfur Peace and Accountability Act, which would expand peacekeeping operations in Darfur, Sudan, and would punish those who have committed genocide there. The bill allowed the president to provide assistance to support the deployment and operations of an expanded African Union mission in Sudan until a United Nations peacekeeping mission could be deployed. It is also called on the UN, European Union, and North Atlantic Treaty Organization to immediately mobilize appropriate resources to support the peacekeeping effort. The bill also slaps sanctions against individuals found responsible for genocide, war crimes, or crimes against humanity in Darfur. The Darfur Peace and Accountability Act, or H.R. 3127, now goes to the president for signature. Representative Barbara Lee, an Oakland Democrat, announced she will push a new bill titled H.R. 6140, which would require the government to deny federal contracts to businesses that are associated with Sudan and would allow states to divest without fear of expensive legal battles.
GOP officials announced today that they will hold their next presidential convention in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis-St. Paul, a location in the politically pivotal Midwest. The convention is slated for September 1st through the 4th of 2008. Losing out were bids from New York City, Cleveland, and a joint bid from Tampa and St. Petersburg, Florida. By picking the Twin Cities for 2008, the GOP hopes to capitalize on the media markets of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa, all battleground states in the 2004 election and ones expected to be competitive in the next presidential race. The Democrats, who last met in Boston, will announce a decision later this fall. Denver, Colorado, is considered to be the current frontrunner candidate for the 2008 convention.
A bill banning California state pension funds from investing in companies with interests in Sudan went into effect yesterday with the signature of Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. The move comes a day after the U.S. Congress passed a bill imposing sanctions on the Sudanese government for its role in the genocide in Darfur that has claimed up to 450,000 lives over 3 years. The new California law could provoke protests and suits by trade organizations who claim that individual states do not have the authority to intervene in international diplomacy. Schwarzenegger said his bill would send a message to strife-torn Darfur that California does not stand for murder and genocide. The federal bill, the Darfur Peace and Accountability Act, only passed the U.S. Congress after a clause was removed that would have protected individual U.S. states from being sued if they divest public pension funds from companies doing business with Sudan. At least 15 states have passed or are considering passing legislation similar to that of California.
Scheduled executions in California have been put on hold since February of this past year, when federal judge Jeremy Fogel ordered the state's method of lethal injection, known as Procedure 770, be scrutinized due to claims that it violates constitutional bans on cruel and unusual punishment. FSRN's Vinnie Lombardo reports from the hearing.
Michael Morales, condemned to die for the 1981 rape and murder of 17-year-old Terry Winchell, received a stay of execution in February when U.S. District Court Judge Jeremy Fogel ordered San Quentin prison officials to ensure Morales would not be conscious and suffer pain when the three-drug cocktail used in lethal injections was administered. At the heart of Morales' legal challenge is the argument that inmates remain conscious during an execution. John Greeley, an attorney representing Morales, says it's unknown if inmates are in pain because the paralyzing drug, pancurium bromide, conceals suffering.
We do know that they're breathing even after they're given the paralytic agent. And those are good indicia of a system gone wrong.
Greeley says the new Procedure 770 guidelines do not ensure less suffering for inmates being put to death.
They don't have a protocol that they've tested. They don't have a team leader. They don't have RNs on the team anymore. It's in complete disarray.
Mark Heath, an anesthesiologist called to the witness stand late in the day, testified that California's execution chamber at San Quentin Prison is needlessly complex and said the new Procedure 770 guidelines are worse than before they changed it. Heath suggested problems with the leadership, attitudes, and training of those administering lethal injections in California have led to inhumane executions. In all, 6 witnesses for the plaintiff were called to the stand yesterday, including 3 lawyers who have represented death row inmates. All 3 described how their clients' chests were heaving violently and convulsing as they were put to death, and all said their clients' eyes were opened for many minutes during the killings. But during cross-examination, they stated they did not know if their clients were conscious. Dane Gillette, California's senior assistant attorney general, admitted Tuesday that state prison guards had botched last year's controversial execution of former Crips founder Stanley Tukey Williams, saying it was a lesson well learned. Guards in that execution struggled for many minutes to insert the tubing into Williams' veins.
What was done and what is done in the name of the people are heinous acts of torture and killing.
Barbara Becknell, a close friend and witness to Tukey's execution, commented she felt vindicated by the announcement.
But you know what? That's an empty and shallow vindication. I still saw torture. I still saw killing. Frankly, I feel the state attorney general's office owes Stan's family an apology and an acknowledgement, and let's see if they have the courage to do that.
Though Gillette admitted mistakes were made, he denied that lethal injection in California amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. Reverend Joy Atkinson, a Unitarian minister in Monterey, California, gathered with a half dozen anti-death penalty protesters for a press conference. Atkinson contends there is no humane way to administer the death penalty.
You can take any given procedure and analyze it as they're doing here with these hearings, but the conclusion has to be cruel and unusual punishment can be applied to all instances of administering death as punishment.
Sarah Tofty, a researcher with Human Rights Watch, says regardless of the outcome, this case is a very important one.
You know, looking at the national landscape, after Judge Fogel ordered these hearings back in February, I think you started to see a lot of movement in other courtrooms to say, you know, I think we need to take a look at our protocols as well.
37 of the 38 states with the death penalty use lethal injection, but executions have been halted in Delaware, Missouri, and New Jersey as those states confront challenges to injection procedures. The hearings in San Jose continue through Friday, and a decision is expected sometime in late October. From the studios of Freak Radio in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Vinny Lombardo for Free Speech Radio News.
Republican Alaskan Senator Ted Stevens has denied rumors that he plans on retiring next year and intends to run for re-election in 2008. Stevens, at 84 years of age, told the Hill newspaper that he intends to stay as long as God and the people of Alaska allow him to secure these projects for Alaska. The senator has recently sparked controversy for a bridge to nowhere, estimated at a cost of $223 million, that connects to a rural town populated by only 50 citizens.
After undergoing a lumpectomy and 25 painful radiation treatments, Lynn Yurusko of Rhode Island got surprising news. She never actually had breast cancer. Yurusko is suing Quest Diagnostics, the NASA radiologic group, and four individual doctors. According to documents filed at State Supreme Court in Garden City, the mix-up resulted when Yurusko's November 2004 biopsy sample was switched with one from another woman. The suit asks that a jury determine damages. Yurusko's attorney, Bob Sullivan, said he expects to go to trial in 2007. Sullivan said Quest should identify the other woman and allow a judge to independently and confidentially confirm that the woman was treated properly. State Supreme Court Judge Roy Mahone rejected that demand last July.
After spending months in remote northwest Florida swamps searching for the ivory-billed woodpecker, researchers say they have seen and heard the rare bird once believed to be extinct. But the Auburn University ornithologists who published their findings in Canada's Avian Conservation and Ecology Journal online yesterday failed to capture a picture of the large woodpecker with the white bill. The bird was thought extinct until 2004 when Cornell University researchers released recordings and an inconclusive grainy video after searching for the bird in the swamps of eastern Arkansas. The last confirmed ivory-billed sighting was in 1944. The Audubon Society team, led by Jeffrey Hill, conducted its search on a $10,000 budget. Hill said extra funding should help them deliver the conclusive evidence the world is demanding.
San Francisco residents can expect the region's already excellent air quality to become even better in the years ahead as the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, and the area's transit system near completion of an unprecedented diesel cleanup program. Through the Clean Diesel Bus Program, more than 1,700 diesel buses from 13 Bay Area transit districts are being retrofitted with diesel exhaust filters. Combined, these high-tech emission control filters annually capture more than 50 tons of harmful particulate matter and 436 tons of oxides of nitrogen that otherwise would have been emitted by buses into Bay Area air, which are precursors to ozone and are linked to respiratory disease. Nearly 1,400 exhaust filters for Bay Area buses already have been delivered. Most of the remaining 340 exhaust filters are scheduled to be installed by the end of 2006.
Public health agencies already urge pregnant women to take multivitamins that contain folic acid early in pregnancy to reduce their fetus's risk of developing a neural tube defect. Now, a study led by the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia has found that prenatal vitamins may reduce the risk of brain tumors in children. Dr. Greta Bunin led a study comparing children diagnosed with those tumors before age 6 to children randomly chosen that are healthy. The children with cancer, the protective effect of the multivitamins taken early in pregnancy was weakly significant, but because it was similar to previous, more statistically significant findings by Dr. Bunin's team in 1993, the authors conclude the apparent benefit is unlikely to have occurred by chance.
More than 67,000 metric tons of nuclear waste are currently stored across 131 sites in 39 states throughout the country. Each year, at least 2,000 additional metric tons are added to that number. A controversial plan to consolidate most of the spent nuclear fuel and high-level waste at one site in Nevada is the subject of legislation introduced today by Senator Pete Domenici, Republican from New Mexico. FSRN's Darby Hickey reports.
Storing nuclear waste, which is highly toxic and dangerous to humans and the environment for thousands of years, is a problem faced by all countries using nuclear energy or building nuclear weapons. President Bush has pushed for consolidation of nuclear waste into one secure facility within Yucca Mountain, located on the military's Nevada testing site in central Nevada.
We need Yucca Mountain, and we will describe the purposes for which it is needed.
Senator Pete Domenici, New Mexico Republican, introduced a bill today that seeks to accelerate the process of bringing Yucca Mountain online as a nuclear waste storage site.
This measure provides DOE with the authorities needed to execute the Yucca Mountain project and to begin long-term emplacement. The three measures discussed today will establish a comprehensive program that will provide confidence that our nation's program will provide that our nation needs nuclear waste and that it will be managed safely both for current and future reactors.
The legislation requires the Department of Energy, which is responsible for non-military nuclear waste, to submit applications to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to both build a surface storage facility and the underground repository at the mountain, a traditional burial ground of the Western Shoshone Nation, who contests the government's claim to the land based on a 19th century treaty. Western Shoshone concerns about environmental effects of the storage site are shared by many others, including Dr. Arjun Makhijani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research.
In my opinion, Yucca Mountain is the single worst repository site that has been investigated in this country. It is not suitable for disposal of radioactive waste because the geologic medium, the rock, is very porous. The pores are full of air, so they have oxygen in them. They have some moisture, so it's a recipe for rust. And they're putting metal containers in them. And, of course, water is in very short supply, so if it gets polluted, it's very likely that people will use it. There's no really good solution for nuclear waste disposal, but there are sites that are the much less risky and that we know would likely have much better performance.
Senator Domenici's bill calls for consolidation of 3,000 metric tons of nuclear waste each year, transporting it by rail to Nevada, a process that concerns critics of the Yucca Mountain Project as well. At that rate, the repository would be full by 2050. This begs the question of what is being done to reduce the amount of nuclear waste being produced. With just 3 days left in this legislative session, the bill will be taken up again in the 110th Congress, when Domenici will solicit input from many sources, according to staffers with the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
The Humane Society of the United States praised Ben & Jerry's for its decision to adopt an exclusively cage-free policy for the eggs used in its ice cream. After discussions with the Humane Society, Ben & Jerry's has chosen to phase out the use of eggs from hens confined in small battery cages where each bird has less than the space of a single sheet of paper. The Vermont-based frozen dessert company will phase in the exclusive use of cage-free eggs over a 4-year period. Ben & Jerry's has also pledged that all of its cage-free eggs will only come from sources that meet the animal care standards of Humane Farm Animal Care, an independent farm animal welfare certifying organization. Approximately 95% of eggs sold in the United States come from birds confined in cramped cages so that they aren't allowed to spread their wings. So intensely confined, the birds cannot engage in many important natural behaviors, including nesting, perching, and walking. Ben & Jerry's joins other socially responsible institutions that have eliminated or are phasing out their use of battery cage eggs, including Whole Foods Market and Wild Oats Natural Marketplace.
They endured a summer of war, ground-shaking airstrikes, and abandonment in the smoldering battlefield of the Israel-Hezbollah conflict. Now Lebanon's unrecognized victims of war, its pets, are being airlifted to the United States for adoption. The Humane Society Beta, or Beirut for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, working with the American Animal Society Best Friends, has gathered up many pets left behind by the tens of thousands of Lebanon's foreign residents and Lebanese with foreign passports who fled the country in July and August. There will be two refueling stops, one in Manchester, England, and another at New York's JFK Airport, before arriving in Las Vegas, where the orphan pets will be put on Best Friends trucks for the 3.5-hour ride to temporary housing at the Best Friends Animal Sanctuary in Kanab, Utah. Best Friends arranged a similar operation a year ago in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina when it brought more than 6,000 animals out of the disaster-stricken zone and to new homes. The Society has also been assisting animal groups in Israel, where people were also evacuated without their pets.
The current time is 5:40, and now time for another daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
What a scream it is to watch the Bushites frantically scrambling around the country in a political effort to trash us opponents of their disastrous war policy in Iraq. Oh, excuse me, George W. instructed us not to call his team's tirades political. When he launched his own ongoing series of speeches to lambast Democrats and other war critics as being soft on terrorism, he declared that his roadshow was not political. Quote, "I seriously hope people wouldn't politicize these issues I'm going to talk about," he whined, as he traveled to a fundraiser for a Republican Senate candidate. Then, Georgia's White House mouthpiece, Tony Snow, bludgeoned Democrats as being, quote, "people who say we shouldn't apprehend al-Qaeda, we shouldn't detain al-Qaeda, we shouldn't question al-Qaeda, we shouldn't listen to al-Qaeda." Wow, such a big mouth, such a small mind. Come on, Tony, name even one Democrat who has said any such thing. Adding his 2 cents, Rumsfeld recently snarled that war critics are people who, quote, "blame America first." Horse feathers, Rummy. We are America. 6 out of 10 Americans oppose your policies. We don't blame America. We blame you. We blame George W., Buckshot Cheney, and your whole flock of ideological nutballs, war profiteers, and chicken hawks. It's time to say the obvious. The Bushites are incompetent losers. They lost Osama. They're losing Iraq. They lost the nuclear confrontation with Iran. They lost New Orleans. Hell, they even lost Pluto. 1/9 of our solar system is gone. This is Jim Hightower saying, the Bushites are blaming Americans for their own failures. We, the people, certainly want to fight the terrorists, but we want to fight them competently and effectively, without lies, without demonizing our own people, and without subverting the very liberties that make America, America.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Immediately after the newscast, stay tuned for The Underground at 6. At 7, it's nonstop hip-hop with DJ Audio. Tomorrow's weather, expect sunny, warm conditions in the Portland area with a high of 87 degrees. For all you folks living in the Columbia Gorge, expect brilliant skies and a similar high of 86 degrees. Savor it while it lasts. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River. Thank you.
The Taliban remains a deep concern among both Afghani and Pakistani leaders. As FSRN's Masroor Hussein reports from Islamabad, the situation is fast growing out of hand for the coalition and its war against terrorism.
President Musharraf today dropped a hint for the first time that Karzai government was faced with a popular uprising in Afghanistan and that he had been warning world leaders about it. He was talking to an American TV talk show.
We are getting late. All this that I've read is what is happening in Afghanistan, in all the provinces. This is a movement going on. This is a Pakhtun uprising by the people going on. If he doesn't understand this, we are going to lose in Afghanistan.
FSRN spoke with General Talat Masood, a close friend of President Musharraf and an expert on the region, to establish the veracity of Musharraf's claim.
The Americans are wanting the Indians to play a role in Afghanistan. And it's quite possible that forces which are averse to the American presence, like the Russians and the Chinese in this area, are also trying to see to it that they support those forces which are somewhat liberal in their outlook in comparison to the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda. They may be supporting them and supporting nationalist forces and somewhat liberal forces, even if they are imbibed by the spirit of jihad.
A senior government analyst told FSRN on conditions of anonymity that Musharraf in fact signed a deal with the Taliban that says it would not operate against Pakistan or provide sanctuary to foreign militants in Waziristan. In exchange, Pakistan would withdraw its army from Waziristan and the establishment of Taliban authority in the region. The Musharraf government has denied the claim. Saidullah is from South Waziristan.
People in the tribal areas are ultra-conservative, which made it easier for the remnants of Afghani Taliban to establish their raid. When the Musharraf government launched its military operation, people believed the United States was behind it. And when innocent civilians started falling victims to the Pakistani army's operation, the entire Waziristan region turned against Musharraf.
No.
The Taliban offered an alternative leadership and they succeeded in thwarting Pakistan's army attacks. This is the reason why they are a legitimate leadership now and have a complete halt.
Masroor Hussein, FSRN, Islamabad.
The public relations company that participated in a controversial U.S. military program that paid Iraqi newspapers to print stories favorable to coalition forces has been awarded another multi-million-dollar media contract with American forces in Iraq. The Washington-based Lincoln Group won a two-year contract to monitor a number of English and Arabic media outlets and produce public relation-type products like talking points or speeches for U.S. forces in Iraq, officials said on Tuesday. The contract is worth roughly $6.2 million per year over a two-year period. The Lincoln Group was mired in controversy last year when it became known that the company had been part of a U.S. military operation to pay Iraqi newspapers to run positive stories about coalition activities. According to the company's website, it was created in 2003 to do public relations and communications work in challenging environments such as Iraq.
Canada's military isn't sending troops to assist the humanitarian crisis in Sudan or elsewhere in Africa. A Liberal senator is charging it's because helping, quote, black African peasants isn't a sexy mission. Senator Peter Stollery made the claim yesterday after General Rick Hillier, the chief of defense state, told the Senate committee that Canada's armed forces is tapped out and unable to send troops to Africa. But Stollery said it was a disgrace that Canada's 62,000-strong military has only 65 of its soldiers serving in a continent that, quote, the whole world knows is going through a terrible time. Liberal Senator Romeo Dallaire, a veteran former general who firsthand saw the genocide in Rwanda, rebuked Stollery for suggesting that war is sexy. But he also accused Canada of being hypocritical and a banana republic for publicly urging international intervention in humanitarian crises like those in Sudan's Darfur and in the Democratic Republic of Congo, while saying it doesn't have the military resources to act itself. The conservative government and now the military leadership has used the excuse of an overstretched armed forces to deflect calls for troops to help with the crisis in Darfur.
Moving on to sexier news. Protests erupted in Indian-administered Kashmir today over the execution date set for a Kashmiri man for his alleged role in the attack on India's parliament in 2001. FSRN's Shahnawaz Khan has more.
Demonstrators took to the streets of Kashmir today after an Indian court fixed an execution date yesterday for Afzal Guru. Guru was handed a death sentence by a court earlier, along with three co-accused, for their alleged role in the 2001 attack on Indian parliament. Five gunmen broke into Indian Parliament complex in December 2001, killing nine people before they themselves were killed. The attack had brought India and Pakistan almost on the verge of a war, as India blamed Pakistan for aiding the attackers. India's Supreme Court later upheld Guru's death sentence, but acquitted two of the co-accused and reduced death sentence of fourth man to 10 years imprisonment. Protesters took to the streets in Guru's hometown Sopore in Indian administered Kashmir, while police fired tear gas shells to disperse angry protesters pelting stones in the summer capital Srinagar. Shops in the busy city centre were closed. Senior separatist leaders Yasin Malik and Ghulam Nabi Sumji were taken into custody along with scores of protesters. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan.
A former Bosnian Serb political leader has been sentenced by the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal to 27 years in prison for crimes against humanity committed against Muslims and Croats in the early years of the Bosnian War. Judges found that the crimes Momcilo committed in 35 Bosnian municipalities, persecution, extermination, murder and deportation, do in fact amount to genocide. But they say prosecutors didn't prove that Momcilo and other Bosnian Serb leaders had the necessary intent to destroy Bosnian Muslims and Croat populations, a key component in genocide conviction. Still, in handing down a 27-year sentence, presiding judge Alfons Ori said Krasicinic played a crucial role in the crimes. Throughout his trial, Momcilo maintained his innocence, saying he never knew about any detention camps or crimes. The tribunal has so far handed down only two genocide convictions, both in connection to the 1995 mass murders at Srebrenica.
Today is World Tourism Day. The United Nations World Tourism Organization, which promotes the industry in its member countries, claims that tourism is the world's largest aggregate export. Yet, there is a dark side to this enormously important business sector. As FSRN's Vinod K. Jose reports, in countries like India, tourists from the U.S. and Europe often prey sexually on children.
Goa, a former Portuguese colony, is perhaps the hottest tourist destination in the East. 2.5 million tourists from Europe and US visited Goa last year, and it also provides employment for thousands of Indians. But there is another side to the story, the exploitative nature of mass commercial tourism. Professor Nina Rao taught tourism for 30 years, now is an activist.
The norms that you follow at home, you do not follow when you're on holiday, right? And you behave like a normless person. You do just what you want because you're letting your hair down. Now, this kind of thing is very unpleasant for a community that is not there on holiday. This is their home. This is where they live. And you cannot just, hordes come in over the new year and roads are blocked, incredible traffic, price rise, and the local people have to live with it.
Arun Pandey runs an organization for the victims of sex tourism in Goa. He is furious at the cruel side of tourism industry.
And what has been reported many times, one customer takes and with five, six of them they have sex. There have been incidents when one customer is having sex, his friends are video filming them. Okay, there have been cases there when the customers, with sadistic, they have burned them with cigarettes. And, they have taken all the clothes and gone and left the girl nude. Okay, so these kinds of incidences are happening. And definitely, leave aside the HIV thing, okay, but like use of condoms and all these things. Because there, the girl is in the control of the customer. And whatever the customer says, the girl has to do.
Telka, an Indian tabloid paper, carried a spy cam investigation on Western tourists coming to Goa for child sex or pedophilia. V.K. Shashikumar was the journalist who did the investigation.
What we did was expose tourism-related pedophilia
Essentially, that meant that a lot of tourists from UK, France, Germany, USA, Australia, and the Scandinavian countries would basically shifted their base from Southeast Asian countries like Thailand and found Goa to be a good, pedophilic destination.
Mala is a sex worker at Baina Beach in Goa. Now she has a baby and thrown out from the beach, making way for a hotel. She is frustrated with her life.
Tell me, where would I go with this baby? Society is very cruel on poor people. Can you please ask them to give us some poison and kill us all?
In the many tsunami-affected coasts of Kerala, business groups are buying land from poor fishermen for throwaway price. Privatization of beaches is a main area of contention between the local communities and the tourism industry. Again, Professor Nina Rao.
I think the areas where there have been conflicts with fisher folk is the area where either golf courses or hotels have privatized public access. And this, I think, no matter what you feel about tourism, that you think it's a great investment and high multiplier and so on, you have no right to privatize public access to any resource.
India earns revenue of $5 billion annually from tourism. But the economic benefits of tourism do not reach to all segments of the host community. For FSRN, from India, I'm Vinod Jules.
On a much lighter note, 3-year-old Jack Neal loves cars so much that while his mother's back was turned, he bought a pink Nissan Figaro for nearly 18,000 euros on eBay. His mother, Rachel, told the British Broadcasting Corporation on Monday that Jack jumped on the chair, went straight in, found the page, and bought the car. Unable to read, the youngster likely used the Buy It Now option to make the purchase. The first time the Neals from Sleaford in eastern England knew of the sale was when they received an email from auto dealer David Jones, who thought he had made his first internet sale. Jones from Worcestershire in central England saw the funny side and said he will not hold the Neals to their purchase. The car will be relisted later. Jack denied all culpability, asked if he had made the purchase. He simply squirmed and muttered no.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 27th, 2006, marking the 1,836th day since Bush said Osama bin Laden was wanted, dead or alive. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032, leave a message on extension 203, or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. That goes for news tips as well. Call us with your news tips at 503-231-8032, extension 203. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Noah Eaton. Our assistant producer is Mike Monkfold. Our wire editors are Noah Eaton and Mike Monkfold. Tonight's audio editor is Mike Monkfold. Special thanks to reporters Marlies Franklin and Edison Carter, but not Mike Monkfold. Our engineer is Brianna Loringer. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afif Ahmed Shafi. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 a.m., it's the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Joanne Bowman hosts Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, Crystal Lady will interview a member of Friends of Lone Fir Cemetery about their future plans for events at the historic cemetery and opportunities to volunteer there on Halloween. At 10, Mia Kim brings us Radio Beyond Borders. This month, her topic is workers' struggles from Portland, Oregon to Seoul, South Korea. At 10:30 on Art Focus, Julie Bernard speaks with Portland artist Tom Kramer. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Volunteer with our news broadcast by calling 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, I'm Lynn Mullick, and I'm running for the board of directors because I believe in this radio station and the mission statement for which it stands. It seems that every week, filling the needs that other media do not is getting to be a larger and larger umbrella, which there's so much work to be done. The way I would like to help is to serve, and I reiterate, serve on the board of directors. I've worked for many progressive causes, from the days of the Southeast Asian Peace Campaign to present-day America, and I'm currently a proud member of Code Pink. Being a small business owner, I've always felt that fairness, cooperation, and people being able to feel emotionally safe in the workplace is as important as the financial bottom line. And it works. I'm sad that KABU is the only independent, non-corporate radio station in Portland. But since it is, I want it to be all it can be. I'm happy to say that there are a wealth of wonderful people running for the board of positions. Please consider me as one, Lynn Mullick.
Subvert KABU's upcoming membership drive by renewing your membership in our fall sweepstakes, where you could be the lucky winner of a $2,000 shopping spree all around Portland. KABU is offering $200 gift certificates from 10 local businesses as the sweepstakes prize. These businesses include Bike Central Co-op, Buffalo Gardens, Cotton Cloud Futons and Furniture, Higgins Restaurant and Bar, Mirador Community Store, Oregon Mountain Community, Portland Saturday Market, The Rebuilding Center, Spa Wilhelmina, and Susan Hebert Imports. If you're a KABU member, you should have already received your entry form in the mail. Entering KABU's fall sweepstakes is easy, but you can't win if you don't enter. To enter, simply mail back your reply card to KABU so that we receive it before 5 p.m. local time on Friday, October 13th. We'll announce the winner on air Saturday, October 14th at noon. If you're a KABU member and haven't received your sweepstakes entry form yet, please contact KABU's membership department at 503-231-8032, extension 207, or send an email to membership@kabu.org.
So, what did you do last night?
Well, first I took a tour of the towns and cities. Stopped to sniff the flowers.
I'm a big fan of orchids myself. I like the way they feel in my hands.
Are you staying in a hotel tonight?
Actually, I'm riding my bicycle home.
Are you eating out tonight?
I don't have much of an appetite. I had a bit of bread and butter earlier.
Well, just be safe and wear a condom.
I was never cool in school. I'm sure you don't remember me.
And now it's been 10 years. I'm still wondering who to be. And I'd love to mix in circles, cliques, and social coteries. That's me.
Hand me my nose ring.
Can we be happy? Show me the mosh pit.
Can we be happy?
Hey, this is KBOO Portland, and you're listening to The Underground. Our show this month is about AIDS and STIs in general, and don't have anything really clever to say, especially after that intro that I hope you all caught, which is really cool. But we are going to start with a piece about HIV testing, and actually... Brianna gives us some information on HIV testing in the Portland area. Here it is.
I don't know just where I'm going. I'm going to try. For the kingdom if I can, 'cause it makes me feel like I'm a man. spikes into my veins. And things aren't quite the same.
When the KBOO Youth Collective first decided on making this month's show all about AIDS and STDs, someone had the idea to actually get tested for HIV, then make a piece about it. Although everyone agreed this was a fantastic idea, no one had the time or money to make it a reality. Finally, I decided I would step up to the plate. After a few hours of research, however, I realized why no one had taken on the task. I'm a young woman who works about 30 hours a week and lacks health insurance. On top of that, I live in Vancouver, Washington, and have limited access to a car. After researching online for several hours, I found several places in the Portland area which a person can get tested for HIV. I even found places online where a person can purchase HIV tests to take in the privacy and comfort of their own home. Things were looking up for me. Having limited time left me unable to purchase an at-home test, and having limited transportation left me looking for clinics or testing centers in Vancouver or North Portland. Again, I found several promising leads. There was a Planned Parenthood, with two locations in Vancouver, and many more in Portland. There was also Outside In in southwest Portland, and all the large hospitals in the Vancouver and Portland area, but most promising was the Clark County Public Health Clinic. Most of the clinics I found offered free or reduced price testing. However, most all of the free testing was for men who have sex with men, with a few places offering free or reduced testing for people who inject drugs or qualify as low income. I called many places but found that most were booked and could schedule me as early as the first or second week of October. So, I am disappointed to say that I have yet to get tested for HIV, though I feel like I am now more prepared to get tested. If you're interested in testing for HIV, there are many ways to do so. Many clinics offer HIV testing, and an FDA-approved home test kit can be purchased online for as little as $47. If you happen to be a man who has sex with men, most places offer free testing one night a week. And if you're lucky enough to have health insurance, talk to your doctor or insurance company about how and where to get tested. If you're sexually active or inject drugs of any kind, I highly suggest making an appointment to get tested. Although we have yet to find a cure for AIDS, there are medications available to help people who are HIV positive, though many work well only if used early on in the infection. Many places will do confidential testing where your results stay off of your medical records. I wish I could tell you firsthand what getting an HIV test is like, but I can still share with you the knowledge I've acquired about getting tested. There are many ways doctors can now test for HIV, making it easy and relatively painless. A person may take a swab saliva test or a Western blot blood test, among other ways. Again, I urge you to make your own choice about where to go and when to get tested, but to help you along in your search, here's a quick recap of places I've found. If you're in the Vancouver area, there's the Planned Parenthood in East Vancouver and Salmon Creek, which can be found online at www.plannedparenthood.org. The Clark County Public Health Clinic at 1601 East Fourth Plain Boulevard in Vancouver offers free testing for men who have sex with men every Thursday night from 5 to 6:30 p.m. and free testing for people who inject drugs every Monday and Wednesday from 3 to 6 p.m. You can also schedule an appointment any weekday, which will cost you about $60, though they have a sliding scale. In Portland, there's the Men's Wellness Center, which offers free HIV testing and STI screenings every Tuesday from 5 to 8:30 p.m. They are connected with the Cascade AIDS Project and can be found on the web at www.cascadeaids.org. Outside In also offers HIV testing for young people on a walk-in basis. They also offer a needle exchange program. All fees are sliding scale based on your income, and for more information, you can check out their website at www.outsidein.org. Tests can also be purchased online at a number of websites for home testing. If you are considering purchasing a home kit, I ask that you please make sure the one you are buying is FDA-approved. A rather inexpensive FDA-approved at-home test can be purchased at www.healthtestingathome.com. Thanks for listening, and I hope you feel more informed and confident about HIV testing. For the KBOO Youth Collective, this is Brianna, signing off. Beginning to see the light.
All right, I'm Jennifer, and a little bit more information about HIV in the United States right now. An estimated 250,000 Americans are infected with HIV but don't know it. It is not uncommon in the United States for people to carry the virus for 10 years or longer and not be aware they're infected, specialists said. New CDC recommendations would change that. Federal health authorities announced a major shift in health policy designed to make HIV screenings as common as blood pressure readings or cholesterol tests. Now, all adolescents and adults up to the age of 64 would be told during a visit to the doctor's office or the hospital that they should be screened for HIV. Patients would still have the option to decline. Those patients believed to be at low risk of catching HIV would typically undergo a single screening and would not have another test until their behavior changed, or unless their behavior changed. Injecting drug users and patients with multiple sexual partners would be encouraged to undergo annual testing.
All right. And now we've got an interview. We're going to Annie with that.
Hi, I'm Annie, and I'm interviewing Ian from the Cascade AIDS Project. So, Ian, tell us about what the Cascade AIDS Project is all about.
Cascade AIDS Project is a nonprofit organization that was founded over 20 years ago, originally when the original HIV outbreak happened in 81. what CAP does is there's services for people who are HIV infected. We have care services, we have housing, we have employment services, we can hook people into medical care. And then the other thing, major part that CAP does is prevention work, prevention with youth, men who have sex with men, injection drug users, people who are at the highest risk for contracting HIV. And we also have community education components, and we have public policy for the local, state, and federal levels.
Okay, great. So what is your job at CAP?
My job, I'm the outreach specialist for the Men's Prevention and Wellness Department. I do outreach work for gay, bi, and men who have sex with men. I go into bars, bathhouses, handing out condoms, lube, handing out information about HIV testing. I do referrals for HIV testing and for mental health and drug and alcohol issues. I also do risk reduction counseling, so one-on-one work with people who want to reduce their risk for contracting HIV. I also help coordinate with the HIV testing and counseling pieces.
Okay, great. What made you choose to be a part of CAP?
CAP. I've been doing this work for about 8 years now, ever since I was in high school. I was a peer educator. And after I graduated high school, went into college, and I needed a job, but then I decided that I really love HIV prevention work and doing sexuality education. So I've known about CAP. I've done some work with CAP in the past, and I originally started as an intern there a little over 2 years ago with the Teen to Teen program. I was redeveloping their curriculum, and then I got a training project through the CDC, and so I stayed on and became a permanent staff member working with the Men's Prevention and Wellness Department, working with high-risk gay and bi men. And HIV and AIDS work, prevention work, education work is something that I've always been passionate about and something that I've been knowledgeable about. So it's mm-hmm. something I wanted to do for a long time.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the Teen to Teen program. Could you tell our listeners what that's all about?
Well, the Teen to Teen program is this awesome, awesome peer education program. It's for teenagers. What it is we train, there's a core group of about 15 teens, and we train them in lots of issues, HIV, AIDS, sexually transmitted infections, sexuality, and what they do is they go out into the community and they train and they educate high schoolers, youth at risk. They do community education for people who work with youth, and we equip them with the tools to do that.
Oh, well, that's great. So what would you say is the importance of HIV, AIDS, STI education for youth?
It's probably one of the most important things, I think, that's out there, because youth today don't get the education in schools, and so it's our job, it's our duty to talk about sex, sexuality, HIV, STDs, STIs, because if you can't talk about it, you shouldn't be having sex. So educating youth is so important. I can't even stress that enough. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's a great philosophy. Well, this is about the end of our interview. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
For parents listening out there and for kids listening out there, go home tonight and talk with your families about sex and sexuality. It can be hard, but it's something that should be done. So go out there tonight and do that.
All right. Well, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Hey, the next piece is about AIDS, and it is about Zoe did this piece, and I'm Zoe, so okay.
South Africa has the largest number of people living with HIV or AIDS. About 20% of its adult population, up from 13% in 1997. No one knows who or what started AIDS. Some people say AIDS started in Africa. Even now, Africa is suffering from AIDS more than America. 17 million Africans have died since the AIDS epidemic began in the late 1970s. 12 million children have been orphaned by AIDS. About 3,927 children were living with AIDS at the end of 2004. 97% probably acquired the infection from their mothers. In the USA, more than 1 million people are living with HIV, and more than 500,000 have died after developing AIDS. Most people live with HIV for years before developing AIDS. AIDS was first identified in the USA in 1981. The epidemic has now spread to every part of the USA and to all sectors of society. AIDS was originally called GRID, gay-related immunodeficiency disease, because homosexual men were the first group of individuals to be hit by the disease. Drug users, mostly heroin users, were the second largest group in America to get AIDS, along with a small population of people who had received blood transfusions. Researchers looked at who was contracting the disease and found that it was contracted through bodily fluids, not because a person was gay. Okay, that was my piece. My name is Zoe.
I have a question.
Yes?
I was wondering if you could tell me, can, you know, someone, a person, get AIDS from the spit of an infected person?
Only if you drink several gallons of it.
Okay. Thank you so much.
As I was saying, this is Zoe Loringer with the Youth Collective signing off.
That was Zoe Loringer with the Youth Collective signing off. Quick little news flash right here. The scientist who helped discover AIDS in the mid-1980s is developing a promising new vaccine approach that may protect people against many strains of HIV. Previous attempts to create a vaccine failed because of the numerous different strains of HIV. A single vaccine would not be effective against HIV in general. This new potential vaccine, which has been used successfully in 4 monkeys, targets a common structure in the virus and therefore might offer protection against many different strains of HIV in different people. The scientist cautions that the vaccine will not usually offer immunity against infection for more than about 3 months. Though it is a step in the right direction, going into remote regions to vaccinate people against HIV 4 times a year is an unworkable plan, they add. Now, we have another interview. This one being done by Cecily. Here you go.
Hi, I'm Cecily. I'm here with Terry Lejeu. She's a program coordinator and adult mental health services director at Outside In. Hello.
Hi there.
So what exactly is the Outside In, and how does it work?
Well, first of all, I'm not the director. I want to correct that because my paycheck doesn't reflect that, but I'm a program coordinator of the risk education programs and mental health services there. Outside In has been around since the mid-60s, and it started out primarily as a health clinic serving the homeless and has expanded over the years. I believe in the 80s they expanded into youth services. So now we have 2 main departments, a health clinic that serves youth as a priority. We have physicians from OHSU who train their residents there, and we'd like to serve youth in the mornings usually up to age 30, and then we also have the naturopathic physicians there from the Naturopathic School of Medicine in the afternoons. There's also an acupuncture clinic, and we have a tattoo removal program. And then I also, the syringe exchange program is part of the clinic. And our youth services is extensive, homeless youth services. We have a day program, drop-in program. We have case management services, housing, and employment readiness programs. So it's pretty great. We also have an alternative school.
Right. So you mentioned syringe exchange. What exactly is that and harm reduction?
Okay. Well, syringe exchange came about in the 80s at the height of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And as you know, as a result to looking at the high numbers of injectors who were infected with HIV and AIDS. So we, Outside In, actually is really a pioneer and started the first program in the United States 17 years ago on November 1st. It was quite a journey and a struggle to get everybody on board to allow us to open the exchange, but Kathy Oliver, the executive director, really worked hard and was able to get it done. So the exchange is also a resource center. We offer HIV and Hep C testing free. We're located at 1219 Southwest Main, and we're open 1 to 6 Monday through Friday. We offer clean syringes, health referrals to the clinic. If someone comes in with abscesses or any kind of health issues, they're sent right over to the clinic. This is a population that usually isn't treated very well when they go into hospitals. They're treated disrespectfully. We refer to treatment, and we also offer harm reduction counseling. Harm reduction, for the most part, has really been more of a term that's been used around reducing risks for certain populations of getting HIV and other infectious disease. But it's expanded now into a psychotherapy model and a counseling model and how to help people think about their drug use, reduce their use, change their use, kind of as a stepping stone to abstinence, and not everyone chooses abstinence.
Right. Is the most common form of people contacting you purely from, like, walk-ins or, like, recommendations from organizations or just people or friends or family?
It's word of mouth. We also have a hotline. Our needle exchange hotline is 503-280-1611, and there are many other exchanges throughout the Multnomah County. We collaborate with the county health department. So folks have known about our exchange because we're the oldest for a long time. So it's word of mouth. We see about 2,000. We have about 2,000 visits a month into our exchange.
Right. So what would you say is the most common population that you typically assist?
You know, we see all socioeconomic groups. There's no commonality. There's all ages, all colors, all sexes. So we're really the majority in terms of age. The highest age group is between 25 and 34. Sometimes people think that IV drug use is only happening, injection drug use is only happening with older populations, and that's just not the case.
Right. So you already kind of touched on a hotline number. Is there any additional, like, contact information or just anything that you'd like to say on topic in general at all?
Okay. Well, I just want to give out Outside In's main number, 503-535-3800. If you need health services or looking, you know, of youth or youth who are looking for housing support, can call us at any time.
Great. I think that wraps it up.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for the interview.
All right. Thanks, Cecily. Now here's a short vox pop of a few of our collective's members, and they are discussing their experiences with public school sex ed.
Well, we learned about contraception in eighth grade mostly, and was with a teacher. She was sort of a weird person. I mean, she had no fears of saying anything, any part of the body. She had no fears of saying anything or grossing us out or anything like that. She had us inflate a condom and then rub baby oil on it, and it popped. I mean, she was just really weird, but it was kind of fun. And and it was educational.
I don't remember too much about what they taught me about contraception in high school because I took that class, biology, it was 10th grade. That was like 6 years ago now for me. But I do remember my teacher saying that something along the lines of, well, I'm just supposed to tell you guys not to do it, but I know that that's not going to be true for everyone, so here's what I'm going to tell you instead.
Well, we both took health in summer school, summer before sophomore year in high school, and it was pretty informative. I guess the only funny thing was, like, I don't know, we were really immature in that class, and we would always make really stupid jokes, like whenever she said anything about the anatomy of a person.
Well, the first time I ever took health class was in middle school in 7th grade, and we had this health teacher. He was kind of a weird guy. He was also our PE teacher. He was kind of creepy, and the main thing I remember about our contraceptives unit is that he took this condom, and put it on his finger. Like, he unwraps it in, like, this very seductive manner, and, like, puts it on his finger, which really disgusted me, and I was like, I'm never gonna have sex if this is what it's gonna be like.
Another funny thing about, like, them teaching us about the responsibilities of, like, having a baby or just being pregnant, like, I remember in middle school, one of the projects in our health class was that we had to have a baby for a week, and it was weird because I shared my baby with Jennifer, but we were supposed to share it with a boy, but there were, like, two boys in our class, so Jennifer and I had a baby. But I guess, I don't know, it was really stupid because we were really irresponsible with it, and our baby was really ugly.
Yeah, her name was Lydia Aloysius Kemp Soga. She really looked like Yoda, and we didn't like her very much.
I have a few memories, like this one time in fifth grade. They had a little box where you could write down embarrassing questions, and I wrote down something that I don't even know, can't even say, and put it in there. And then they read it, and everyone was like, who wrote that? And I totally never said it was me, because I was like, why did I write that? That's retarded. I also remember them, like, demonstrating how to apply the condom on a wooden ballast. The lady who was doing it was like, yeah. And then when you're done, you take it off like this. But, of course, you know, it's not really going to be this hard anymore. And, you know, awkward moments, that's what high school's about. The main thing I came away with was this really profound sense of fear about pregnancy. And I'm still dealing with it today.
I think we got a couple minutes, but
that was a
Vox
Pop.
They're not going to turn the mics on until
Yeah.
But you know about the general distance from a mic.
All right. Anyways, that was Vox Pop. Now for an interesting article. A recent study tracked all people aged 13 and older in New York City known to have AIDS, which is actually more than 68,600 people. Between 1999 and 2004, and during that time, a total of 12,715 New Yorkers known to have AIDS died, and nearly three-fourths of those deaths were linked to HIV. But more than 3,000 weren't related to HIV, according to death certificate information. The percentage of deaths not linked to HIV rose by 33% over the course of the study. The study credits the success of antiretroviral drugs for the shift, and notes that while death certificate information may not be perfect, many non-HIV related deaths were preventable. The top three unrelated causes of death were substance abuse, heart disease, and non-AIDS defining cancer.
And now we've got an interview with Josh Olmsted and his guest.
Like, yes, I like to talk down here, yes.
Now? Hi, this is Josh with the KB Youth Collective, and I'm interviewing Wayne from Q-Land, and we're here to talk about who they are and what work they do in Portland. So, Wayne, how are you connected with QLAN, and how long have you been there?
Thank you, Josh. I have been with QLAN for about 2-3 months. I just moved back to Portland from New York City in July and was looking for an open, welcoming gay community in Portland and saw QLAN online. And just to let you know, QLAN is a group that empowers diverse men in Portland, Oregon to discover and manifest their individual and collective potential for wellness, community, friendship, intimacy, spirituality, and play.
Mm-hmm. What's the purpose and goals of like what QLAN wants to kind of do here in Portland?
QLAN's main focus is to give a place where men can focus on health and wellness, and structures programs and events around those, offering events like yoga events, dating labs where men can come and talk about intimacy and the challenges they have with intimacy. We have contact improv workshops. On October 7th, we're going to have the men's spirit pajama party, lollygagging 101, where men can just sit around and relax and not have to do anything.
How long has QLAN been in Portland? I've just heard about the organization about a week ago. So what's their kind of base here?
It started about 3 years ago, and they started as mainly testing for HIV and STDs in the bars and going into the bars and trying to test for those areas. And have since moved towards focusing on trying to provide systems of alternate health care for men, since healthcare is being less and less funded in our world, in the United States, and focusing on other ways of giving health and wellness.
So you definitely have a really direct connection with kind of the AIDS issue in Portland and the kind of the world. I mean, it is a big issue right now. Do you still offer any kind of programs that focus on that kind of health? Or
our focus is much more on prevention and making health and wellness the first priority instead of having to deal with you getting sick and then dealing with it. We're really trying to be holistic from the front.
Yeah, I definitely see that as kind of like a trend that the world is trying to move towards, which is good. You're moving towards treatment on the prevention for years to come.
And my specific role within QLAN, which I didn't mention, is the youth coordinator, and I coordinate YOHOS, a benevolent society, Young Homosexual Benevolent Society, mainly for men under 30, and I'm doing a cooking event at my place, actually, on October 20th. It's to provide a place and an alternative to the bar scene and online hookup where men can come together, hang out outside of alcohol, smoking, or consciousness-changing drugs, and just hang out and have fun.
What do you feel you have gained from spending your time and work with this organization?
I've definitely been able, given tools and experiences, to focus on my own health and wellness, and I've been able also to give back to the community. I've been able to facilitate dating labs. My background is as a teacher, and I taught kindergarten in New York City. And so my goal is to really empower the other men in the community and giving them tools and ways that they can talk about intimacy, talk about ways of focusing on health in a playful, safe way.
Have you seen other organizations like this in other cities you've been to, or is this more unique to Portland?
I know that the model that QLAN is created out of is based off of other organizations. There's Gay City in Seattle, I think Manifest Love, which is based out of San Francisco. But specifically with Portland, there's been a 7-year rise in HIV, gonorrhea, and syphilis, and that this is what is sort of creating the perfect storm that QLAN is born out of.
What do you think is one of the best kind of like, what do you think is a way right now that people in Portland can really try to stop STDs locally?
The first thing I'd say is communicate. In a recent study with men who have sex with men that have unprotected sex, it's been noticed that the one thing that doesn't happen is men don't talk about their HIV status or STD status before they start. They either assume, well, I'm HIV positive, so the other person I'm about to have sex with must be HIV positive too. There's no communication, and usually many of these unprotected sex situations come out of being at the bar scene and either drug or alcohol induced, so there's less inhibitions and less need to communicate. So the main thing is talk about sex, talk about your sexual identity, talk about getting tested with the other person, or just what your status is with the other person. Communicate, communicate, communicate.
What's a good way for a person who's never really worked with this organization before? What's a good way to get in touch with them? And
you can check out our website, www.qland.org. And I'm not sure I said what QLAND stands for. QLAND stands for Queer Love Action Network of Discovery. So you can go to www.qland.org. You can call us at 503-223-8822. And there's a large website with lots of different information for events and our goals and missions.
Okay. Thank you very much. If you need to get in, if you want to get in touch with QLAND one more time, what was the way to reach them?
QLAND.org. You can email me at yoho@QLAND.org. That's Y-O-H-O, QLAND.org, @QLAND.org.
Thank you very much. This has been Wayne from QLAND, and this is Josh from the Cable Youth Collective.
All right, thank you, Josh. That was an interview, fabulous interview. I just want to remind our listeners, you are listening to The Underground, the once-monthly KBOO Youth Collective show, public affairs show. And up next is a book review from Brianna.
First received my copy of Sex And, I was a little intimidated. To begin with, it's a hefty book, over 300 pages, all about sex. Secondly, the cover tells everyone around you exactly who you are and what you're reading. The rather blunt cover clearly reads Sex And, a radical book for 15 to 22-year-old people. Once I started reading it, however, the book proved to be very interesting. The author, simply called Becca, approaches sex as encompassing all parts of life, affecting and being affected by your past, present, and future. Instead of the typical, young people have sex and should be careful when they do it, text I was expecting, I was warmly welcomed by pages conversationally explaining how to identify what emotions you're feeling, how incest and other traumatic childhood experiences normally happen and normally end up affecting people in adulthood, and the common misconceptions young people have about relationships and sex. Although this book is definitely a time commitment and seems to be directed largely at a heterosexual audience, Sex And is a book any young person, sexually active or not, should take a glance at. Sex And, a radical book for 15 to 22-year-old people by Becca, is published by BookSurge. The book is available online at Amazon.com or by calling 1-866-308-6235. For the KBOO Youth Collective, this is Brianna, signing off.
Thanks for joining us, Chris. We were wondering if you had any words of wisdom concerning STDs that you'd be willing to relate to us.
Never trust your partner. That's ignorant speaking, not malevolence.
Yeah, it's funny because we've been talking about STDs, but we're still not sure about what we can say exactly on the air. Can we discuss pus, outbreaks, that kind of thing?
In reference to the FCC.
Right.
Generally, the FCC allows discussion if it's for scientific or health issues. What we get from our attorney in the last year or so is that some of these defenses for context, it's a public affairs show, you're talking about something that's clinical. Why would that offend any normal person? But if a complaint is filed now, you have to have a very strong case to defend the context of why you use the language. For music or for public affairs, if context disappears and you're just saying one word used in any interview or any song or any newscast might get you into trouble. This is something that hasn't happened in over 30 years. Legitimate discussions, we get back to STDs. Legitimate discussion, why would that get any radio station or television station into trouble? It shouldn't. I think that's the point. One of the things that the FCC does that scares public media and small independent radio stations is you don't really know what's wrong or not wrong unless you get into trouble. Commercial networks have far stronger cases to defend themselves than KBOO would or a college station.
Right.
We don't have the resources.
Well, yeah, we were trying actually to get away from kind of the clinical language for the purpose of this show. because we didn't really want to put people to sleep. But
tell a few jokes.
Right, exactly. That's kind of what I was getting to. A few of us went down to a local clinic, and we kind of hit up some of the people in the waiting room, and we kind of asked them if they could tell any jokes about or related to sexually transmitted diseases. And we found that no one knew any jokes about sexually transmitted diseases.
Oh, clean.
That they were clean, yeah, that they were willing to say in the waiting room. So,
yeah, that's fertile breeding ground for,
right,
for genital warts and herpes jokes.
Right, right, right. So we actually ended up coming up with a couple. I don't know, we're hoping they'll be deemed appropriate. That's probably why they're not funny. Anyway, but let me just run one by you, and you could respond.
I'll do my...
Okay, okay, okay. So there's this old Nazi, and he walks into a bar in São Paulo, Brazil, where he's in exile, and he looks around the empty room, and he asks the bartender, "What came of that wonderful waitress who used to work here, Maria?" And the bartender takes a handful of beans from a basket on the counter, and he throws them at the Nazi and says, "Gonorrhea." "Is that so?" the Nazi says. "I must pay a visit." So that was the joke.
Mm-hmm. I like it.
How did you feel about it? I noticed you didn't laugh.
No, I'm laughing on the inside.
You're laughing on the inside?
That's right.
Okay.
That's smooth.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if people, like, get it. I don't know.
The comedy club's loss is KBOO's game.
Right, right. The second joke was more allegorical. It's in my pocket. I need to get it. I was hoping you could read it, Chris.
There's a joke in your pocket?
Yeah. All right. Here's the
joke. Oh, I'm
going to
read this one.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's a strict Catholic, but in his free time, he's a compulsive gambler. Anyway, he gambles from home a lot, online. He's always gambling. He rents a lot of movies about gambling. The movies help him let loose and want to spin the dice. But every time he has to fold, the shame of all the time he's devoted to gambling gets to him, so he goes to church every night for confession. The priest tells him to repent for his sins. He tries, but all the Hail Marys just make him want to gamble more. In fact, to him, Mary would look pretty good on a deck of cards. Oh, well, now he has herpes. See, if Jackie Mason was Catholic, that'd be a real crowd to be going.
Really?
Yeah.
So what'd you think of that one?
The Nazi one's better.
Yeah.
You told it better.
Uh-huh.
We'll have to see how people feel about that.
But it's like, so in your opinion, is this something that we could say on the radio?
Herpes?
Fear of backlash? No, I mean, not the word herpes, but just telling the joke and all that.
I probably,
okay.
If I was the program director of KBOO, I'd probably clear it.
Okay,
say,
okay.
Take our chances.
Okay, okay.
I got to get back to work.
Oh, really?
I got a radio station to run.
Oh, really? You don't? Okay.
And that was August with his debut piece for the Underground, and I very rudely neglected to introduce that, but that was a candid discussion of the on-air liabilities relative to this month's topic of STDs between August and Chris Merrick, the KBOO program director. And now, last month, there's this piece I did. Well, last month on Randomonium, the youth's music show, I had a hip-hop group in to perform live, and they were very excellent, and I took the time to interview them as well. So, I'm going to play that interview for you guys. And here it is.
Here we go, DJ Malfunction on the wheels of steel. Check it out. My name is Harry Mack. That's just an abbreviation of my actual name, which is Harry McKenzie. I'm 16 years old, and I'm one of the two MCs in State of Mind.
I'm Jack Bars, a.k.a. DJ Malfunction.
I'm one of the two DJs. I was the only one present tonight because the other DJ is in he's in London, and I'm 16 years old.
My name's MISC, which is short for miscellaneous. It's like the abbreviated thing because I don't want to be defined, you know, whatever. I'm an MC, the other MC, and I'm 16.
I was wondering, how long have you guys been MCing?
Let's see. I think I started in sixth grade with my friend Brady, which is the other DJ in the group. So I guess it would be about 5 years now.
Wow. And you
said? A little less for me, just 3 years, I think.
Okay. And how long have you been turntabling?
I've been DJing, I guess, since seventh grade or eighth grade. Eighth grade's when I got my turntable, so I started in seventh grade.
And how long have you been together as a group?
Brady and I started State of Mind back in sixth grade, so 5 years ago. And then just a couple years ago, we joined with Jack and Alon. I mean, we had always been good friends, and we'd always been working together before we all joined. But, yeah, they were Misfunction at the time, and then we just joined up, Brady and I, MISC, and Malfunction to form what's now the State of Mind crew.
Do you remember that CD you sent us here?
Yeah. It was just a demo, I think, with four songs on it.
It was, it's like one of my favorite things that we've submitted. And you're talking about a new CD that you've got.
Yeah. We're just wrapping up a CD, which is going to be called Moving On Up. And we don't have an exact date, but...
fall, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully this fall it'll be ready. For information on that, you can find us at myspace.com/stateofmindcrew.
Okay. Independently produced, going to burn it all yourself?
Yeah, recorded, and mixed by us.
That's awesome. I would definitely recommend that everybody look into acquiring one of those CDs. Well, okay, unless you guys have anything else you want to get in here real quick.
Hey, yeah, thanks a lot for having us.
Yeah, I want to thank Kevin.
I love that part where you worked me into that.
That was amazing.
You can get some rhymes some more.
Spit some rhymes some more, that's what I'll do. Get back on the microphone while some K through. Yo, Harry McIntyre is never low key. Put a man miss with the bottle of SOB. I think it might be water, but yo, it's no bother. When I'm on the mic, yo, you always feel the slaughter. When I'm on the microphone, I befriend you. Got hooked up on K Brew from Ben 2. Hooked it up through MySpace, yo, that's my man. When I'm on the microphone, yo, you cannot stand the lyrics that I'm spitting when I'm live in the place. Harry Mack, yo, he's never a disgrace. By the way, if true fact you want to find, go to myspace.com/stateofmind. Yo, you can find my picture on the site. When I'm on the mic, yo, you know I'm always hyped. Someone is now walking through the door. He's got a blue shirt on, he wants to hear some more. Yo, he's rocking the khakis. Yo, it's Harry Mackie. Now Alon wants to rhyme, so I pass it back, G.
Back, G, like I grabbed the mic like a khaki. Now I'm coming back, yo, he was wearing khakis. Yo, I'm wearing shorts, the cargo. You should understand where the bars go. Yo, miss, he never understands his car flow. Yo, I drive a Honda Civic. I drive it, I've driven it. Yo, I f***ing driven, I drip it down like you couldn't get the spigot.
Yeah.
You understand that Misk is coming big like a frigate. A friggin' train coming out the train. Misk is coming in and he doesn't expel his pain on the, yo, the radio dial that you're slipping. Misk is always ripping when the mic that he's ripping is tight. But you understand what he does? Not a fright, he bites the mic like it's his life. Pass the microphone every goddamn night to Harry back and you can go and chomp, take a bite.
Chomp, take a bite like it was a cookie. Yo, if you want some live flows, you should book me. Yeah, I talked to your agent on the phone. He doesn't like the underground, so he left me alone. I told him, yo, why you always gotta act whack? You know you want some style you can only get from Harry Mack. But he said he called the abstract. He wanted the quest. I guess they're the best. It's all good, yo. Take it back to an old era. When I'm on the mic, I bury ya. My name is Harry. Better listen up. I make the decision to split your throat so you get the quote. Yeah, I'm a hypnotist, I make you go to sleep. When I'm on the mic, yo, my flow is never cheap. You should come into my town and buy it. If you can't get a plane ticket, your city starts to riot, cause they wanna buy it right now. When I'm on the microphone, I spit like a gat, like pow. Yo, I got all the tricks. My man in the dark room, yo, he's on the mix. Yeah, he puts his hands in the air. Yo, when I'm on the mic, sometimes I swear it's all good, cause the FCC best not be sweating me. I thought it was the Miz, let's see what he can say. He'll kick some more funky lyrics with no delay.
No delay, like it's not coming straight. This is coming on the track, like you should go and call fate. Like, hey, fate, what's next for me? You understand that I shouldn't take some ecstasy? Sex with me? Nah, fate, I'm just slaying. Miz is always saying he's a super saiyan. He's transforming, like, transforming. Like, you understand that he's not a f***ing Mormon. He's Jewish, you knew this. Coming on the track, leaving your face blue. It's like you got blue balls and called new cars. Like, you didn't know, cause I'm too far from away from the abstract slinging. Miz is always bringing when the track is slinging. Yo, I'm not cringing, yo, I'm not flinching, cause the track is mine, I grab it like a piece. You should understand that Miz is not gonna cease and desist, like the cop said, cause Miz will rock them until they all day. Cool.
Haha, yeah! You've been listening to Freestyles by Miz and Harry Mack, piece of DJ Malfunction, for providing us with the record. Yo.
Yo. Yo. That was State of Mind, and they were excellent on KBOO, and if you didn't hear, you can check them out at www.myspace.com/State of Mind. Crew. State of Mind crew. And I invite you to enjoy another one of their amazingly good musical creations right now.
I'm unable to rest in the stable. I wanna strangle myself with a headphone cable connected to the stereo on the bedside table. Tossing and turning in my cradle with a day full of stress and anxiety. Trying me from the dream world that I try to see. Clearing my debris is hard.
More difficult than it appears to be. When I close my eyes, I'm blind, and what I could once see is no longer clear to me. My reading light stays on. That's the proper lighting. I wish the demon from a nightmare could rewrite this poem that I was up late writing. Change the side notes to music notes and compose a lullaby to put me to sleep. While the face of the moon weeps, count all of God's sheep, and I might drift. Because I sleep like an angel working both the day and night shift. When the neighbor's lights switch from on to off, I walk slowly to the loft and rest my head on the pillow, which never seems soft enough. And my extra firm mattress doesn't have the proper touch. These sticks and stones are good materials to rest my aching bones. Poetry's all I have to give. I just wanna live, I never sleep. Cause sleep is death's blood relative. The monster under my bed snores too loud. I focus on my breath, I never sleep. Because I'm scared to death. The sign on my door says keep out, but I expect a drop in from the sand. I hope it doesn't sprinkle sand in my eyes while they're still wide open. Trying not to drown in the deep sleep that I seldom float in. My saltwater bed is better known as the Pacific Ocean. I wish I had a magic potion, but instead I have to wait for my eyes to close in upon themselves in the state of awareness is gone. Last night I dove in with no hesitation, waiting, but I didn't know when I was drift away. And my eyelids were so thin I could see through to the next day. And everything I'd have to go through, people push me around like, I don't know you. I wish what I showed you with my pen wasn't so true, but it's no new story. The daily ritual was born. I let the late night shine in all of their glory. So here I am today, sleep in my eyes. It's too bad that's the only place where I can find it. And even when it tries to escape, it fails. The curtains are closed, it's trapped inside a single cell, which will multiply and grow. It goes nowhere. It only builds. I wish I could have it killed. A cavity in my eye which can't be drilled and then filled. But believe me, I wish it was that easy. When I lie down at night, my sense of time seems to leave me. So I'm left to think the night away. Thinking until the light of day is given right of way. Then right away I rise and put on my disguise. I wish I could listen to music when instead I have to listen to lies. My inner prisoner can't sleep. I need a glass of water. Can't sleep. So why do I even bother? Can't sleep, now I'm up, burning all my written. Cause dead the bite lines from this poem and taught me wisdom. Can't sleep, I'm up all night. Can't sleep, I'm trying to keep tomorrow out of sight.
can't sleep, but it's not a problem. I'm just happy the day is through. Never sleep, every time I wake, the day is new. And not every song fits the mood, so I can't simply play it through. I make deep sleepers say, Abbo, I will pray for you. But I don't think they do, cause I don't see much improvement. They probably despise me and think I see how late I can stay up for my own amusement. When I sleep, it's rapid, rapid eye movement. My sleep is shallow, and I'm old, I'll follow with a bod crane to Sleepy Hollow. I don't have the patience to sleep, to build models. And I have the most common sign of an ex-priest daughter. Never satisfied with a glass of water, even if it's bottled. The angels that watch over me wear pretty masks, but they're creeps. They shove lullabies down my throat like, for the love of God, sleep. Okay, okay, just go away. I should have you fired. All I asked for was some peace and quiet. I'm so tired. I'm not a liar, I'm tired of not sleeping. It's not even fair, I have to watch as my thoughts weaken. I'm deep in sleep with this and can't piece words together when speaking. I sleep right Saturday and Sunday, only seem intelligent on the weekend. I see them coming, change my name to Rip Van Winkle. That sleep in my eyes, don't mistake it for a twinkle. The ghost that haunts my house in the clock's like 12, she's writing me love letters. Dear Adam, never change, all of you forever. Now I'm thinking back to the first night I met her, while the bags under my eyes are arguing with my bloodshot veins. But who can tell the story better? I copyrighted just to fight them, that isn't fair. Is that what you can do? What are you gonna do? Make an appearance in my worst nightmare? I don't think so. You can't blow up my candles, be gone. It's my life that I keep on till the break of dawn. Some kids shove sarcasm down my throat when I yawn. Crack jokes and stay in my face, they're just letting me know it's on. I wish you could say something to make everything seem better. I'm the sleepless demon that can't get through your dream catcher. I wanna kill that part of me cause it's leaving the rest of me scarred. Plus I'm getting tired of shifting in and out of the graveyard. And I know that it's hard to read me. You probably can't find me. I doubt you really need me. If I don't see myself and it seems things aren't what they seem, it's probably cause I'm living through my daydreams. Ah, can't sleep. I need a glass of water. Can't sleep. So why do I even bother? Can't sleep, now I'm up, burning all my written. Cause dead the bright lines from this poem and taught me wisdom. Can't sleep, I'm up all night. Can't sleep, I'm trying to keep tomorrow out of sight. Can't sleep, but it's not a problem, I'm just happy the day is through. Never sleep, cause every time I wake, the day is new.
Can't sleep, can't sleep.
All right, now for the calendar events for the upcoming month of October. KB Youth Collective's monthly music show, Randomonium, will air this Friday, September 29th from 10 to 11 p.m. Girl Fest, Everything Cool About Being a Girl, is a free event for girls of all ages at the Portland Expo Center, Saturday, September 30th. There will be over 100 exhibitors, and girls and their families can learn about local resources and opportunities. Activities include engineering, woodworking, boating, rock climbing, and more. This event is sponsored by Girl Scouts Columbia River Council.
Visit Portland Art Museum now through Sunday, October 8th, for the final week of the Oregon Biennial Show 2006, a celebration of some of the Portland art scene's greatest contemporaries, including Holly Andrus, Sandra Bocci, and Houston. Actually, I went to this show. It's pretty amazing. I would definitely recommend this piece of art that shows a file cabinet with white painted arrows shooting into it, which I think represents something about Native Americans in today's culture. So while you're there, stop by the museum's Jubit Center and see Pierre Huygens' video installation. This is not a time for dreaming, a dreamlike puppet show inspired by the designs of architect Le Corbusier and modern utopianism. This is not a time for dreaming runs through Sunday, December 31st. For more info, visit www.portlandartmuseum.org.
Gabriel Bomer, author of City of Readers, A Book Lover's Guide to Portland, will be speaking at Powell's Books on Hawthorne Monday, October 9th at 7:30 p.m. In his book, he names the 25 best reading spots in Portland.
Portland's Independent Publishing Resource Center is open every Sunday from 12 to 5 for their zine canteen, a free drop-in time for youth 8 to 18 to learn more about zines and self-publishing. The IPRC also provides youth with the resources for publishing their own zines. The IPRC is located at 917 Southwest Oak Street, Suite 218 in downtown Portland. For more info, please visit www.iprc.org.
And King Elementary School is currently seeking volunteer tutors for its after-school homework club on Tuesdays and Thursdays. For more information and to sign up,
and for many other community volunteering options, please visit www.handsonportland.org. Also, you can apply now for the Fall School to Work program at OMSI. Applications are due Friday, September 29th. School to Work is a free 10-week program for high school students aged 14 to 18. Participants gain valuable volunteer experience in one of the country's top 10 science museums while receiving training in customer service, public speaking, and creating hands-on presentations. Most importantly, students have fun while learning science and giving back to their community. Applications and more information are available at OMSI's website, www.omsi.edu. That's O-M-S-I. Go ahead and check it out.
Now this one's the sneaky spirochete. The corkscrew-shaped germ that causes syphilis is so tiny that 3,000 of them, laid end-to-end, will measure only 1 inch. The spirochete moves readily from person to person by direct skin-to-skin contact during lovemaking and intercourse. It thrives in the warmth and moistness of the human body. Okay, picture number 3, please.
Thanks for listening to The Underground. The Underground is hosted every fourth Wednesday by the KBOO Youth Collective. We meet every Wednesday at KBOO at 6 p.m. to plan our show. If you're interested in getting involved, come on down or call our youth advocate, Aaron Yankee, at 503-231-8032, extension 511, or email her at kbooyouth@hotmail.com. We also do a music show, Youth Randomonium, the last Friday of every month from 11 to midnight, and we're always looking for new music by anyone under 21 of any style. And check out our website at kbooyouth.org. The first and third Wednesdays of the month, Circle A Radio airs at this time. And the second Wednesday of the month, Hole in the Bucket, a public affairs show on homelessness, airs from 6 to 7. Next up is DJ Audio with Nonstop Hip Hop. Thanks for listening.
Venereal diseases are caused by living germs that reach you when your body is in intimate contact with that of an infected person. Now, if you suffer from any venereal disease, don't try to cure yourself. A person who tries self-treatment for venereal disease has a fool for a doctor. Don't try to cure yourself. Don't try to cure yourself. Don't try to cure yourself. Don't try to cure yourself.